Marriage, said Mae West, is a great institution, but I ain't ready for an institution yet. For most people, in most times, in most cultures, there has been some form of marriage that legitimizes a sexual relationship between a man and a woman. And just recently, the Netherlands became the first modern nation to decide that same-sex marriages should be treated the same as the old-fashioned kind. In 1999, Vermont became the first and so far only American state to bless same-sex unions, stopping short of calling them marriages. But all this is happening as the old reasons for getting married, security, sex and children, are slipping away, especially for women. To be a wife ain't what it used to be. Even 20 or 30 years ago, when women in their last year of college said they were working on their MRS, they wanted to get that ring by spring. Today, women are marrying later, if at all. And what it means to be a wife is changing, just as it has changed radically over the centuries. Connection listeners, what does it mean to have or to be a wife in the year 2001? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join the What's a Wife Connection. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us online at theconnection.org. Joining us by phone today is Marilyn Yalom, a senior scholar at the Institute for Women and Gender at Stanford University and author of a new book, A History of the Wife. Marilyn Yalom, welcome. Here in the studio with us is E.J. Graff, a journalist and author of What is Marriage For? Welcome, E.J. Graff.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Marilyn, can I start with you? You've said in your book that for all the twists and turns in the history of marriage, you still believe the book of Proverbs had it right, whosoever findeth a wife finds a good thing. Ouch. But don't you also say that the wife is an endangered species?
Yeah, she's an endangered species in some of her roles, because all of the past associations to the wife as someone who services her husband are in danger of disappearing, since women have taken on so many new roles, specifically in the work sphere, working for pay. Women have always worked, but now wives are expected to bring in a paycheck as well as providing many of the services that they have in the past, domestic and providing for offspring. So something's got to give.
Well, indeed, you sort of deconstruct, you know, the wifely role in your book, you know, through history. She's no longer just a childbearer. She's no longer a piece of property. She's no longer reliant on her husband for her economic stability. There's not much left, is there?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There's a partnership. There's being a companion, giving mutual support, being the witness of another person's life, sharing, loving, sex, living in a household. There's still a good bit, including the possibility of having offspring, although that's no longer perhaps the primary and certainly not the exclusive reason for people to marry today.
Well, let's bring in E.J. Graff here. You said you were never really sure you wanted the word wife to apply to you.
Well, I'm quite sure I never want the word wife applied to me.
But you have actually gone through a sort of marriage to your partner, to your spouse, Madeline.
We had a ceremony in 1991, and I did not call it a marriage for a long time. Whenever she called it a wedding, I just grimaced, because I had this come of age in the 1970s with this feminist vision of marriage, which seemed very accurate. My mother had gotten married in 1957 and then predictably, as half of that cohort did, got divorced in the 1970s.
Oh, that's cynical.
Oh, it's not cynical. They married so young. It was really shocking, much younger than the historic norm. The 1950s was a very strange time for a marriage. But so it was pretty natural that they would break up in such numbers. But watching what marriage had done to my mother, that 50s model of marriage, and then watching what the divorce did to her, of course, made me very much an enemy of marriage. I never wanted to be what had been done to her. And then when I had the ceremony with Madeline, it was so much more powerful and so much more, I hate to say this word, wonderful than I expected, and so much larger, given that we were already, you have to be pretty committed to get up and have a queer ceremony. You really do, to drag your family in.
There are a lot of problems with words here, aren't there? Partner or spouse or... Mm, do you think same-sex unions, what's happening with people like you, means that really the word wife, not only for people like you, but is becoming a bit of an anachronism?
Well, Marilyn would know better than I would. I do know people who are very happy to claim the word wife. It's efficient. Everybody knows what you mean when you say husband or wife.
Marilyn, what do you mean when you say wife? If you, how do you separate it from mother?
Well, there is considerable overlap between wife and mother, at least historically. But today, when one says wife, you take on the role not only of the female spouse in a heterosexual relationship, but you take on a certain tradition in which you're willing to be the one who is more nurturing, more, I hate to say dependent, because that's not necessarily the case of many, many wives, but you are willing to see yourself in something of a traditional role. And what is amusing to me is that very often people today use the word wife ironically. Mm-hmm. I'll call up a friend and he'll say, well, I'll put my wife on the phone. And the word wife is beginning to take on these overtones of something anachronistic. And that's why I say the traditional wife is perhaps an endangered species.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, for all you members of the endangered species, if you'd like to have your last word on the air. E.J. Graff, Marilyn was talking there about love, about companionship. But it's true, isn't it, that historically, for centuries, what marriage was, what a wife was, it was an economic bargain.
Absolutely. Marriage has been through many dramatic revolutions in history. But the one that affects us most is the one that took place in the 19th century. Marriage really went through upheaval, dramatic upheaval, much more than we can imagine, between 1850 and roughly 1940, so much so that a lot of people thought marriage and family were dead. The big upheaval was that exactly what you say, because of the Industrial Revolution, men could make their living independently. They got shoved out of the house. They'd before been working in partnership with their wives. And suddenly they're off alone, making the family living, and women are downgraded to servants, which they had formerly hired, adolescent servants, and start becoming housewives. So the meaning of wife and the meaning of marriage had to change.
Marilyn, when were the rules set down? I mean, in your book, you start with Adam and Eve, and we can even dispute whether Eve was a second-class citizen or whether she was superior. But when were the rules set down? Because in ancient Greece, the woman had some parity, but not total Greece. I notice in the Roman Empire, you say the woman had near equality, but she didn't have the key to the wine cellar. I mean, how were the rules for what was a wifely role established?
Well, our Judeo-Christian tradition has its roots both in the two testaments and also in Greek and Roman society, and they didn't treat the wife exactly in the same way. What they had in common was the patriarchal system. The chief of the clan or his representative, the father or the older brother, could dispose of the wife. She was given, so to speak, by the father to the prospective groom. With her consent, it appears, but that's hard to determine. Certainly in ancient Greece, that was the case too. The ritual formula for a father was to say, I give Antonia to the name of the bridegroom for the express purpose of providing legitimate offspring. So her role as wife mother was written into the ritual. And it is only with the late Republic, Roman Republic, and the early Roman Empire that you begin to have some kind of parity. And I say some kind of parity between husband and wife, because that really applied only to the patrician class. Women began to be able to give themselves of their own consent. And it is this idea which entered into Christianity and into canon law, and which has formed the basis of our idea of marriage in the West.
E.J. Graff, is marriage strictly a Christian idea? I mean, because as you'd expect, both of your books are very white, westernized perspectives. I mean, did it arise with, well, obviously not with Christianity, if it goes back to the Greek and Roman times, but what was the root? I mean, is it natural that one man and one woman should live in a consensual, voluntary, monogamous relationship?
Well, you put too many terms in there. Marriage has existed in every recorded society, not just Western, not just white, which you can't necessarily consider the North Africans white. But the rules change dramatically from one incarnation to the next. I can't tell you, as I was researching it, I used to just sit in my office and laugh out loud because it's so much more varied than you can imagine. The idea of monogamy, for instance, when imposed by Christianity, that was a fight that took 500 to 700 years before Christianity really got that imposed on the medieval lords, the idea that you had one spouse for life.
But wasn't it mostly the case that the woman had one spouse for life?
Well, exactly. That's why I say, I mean,
divorce was rare for the woman, but not...
That again, depends. The upper-class Romans in the late empire, the woman could divorce just by leaving. I mean, she could go back to dad and take back her dowry. So she could divorce just as easily as the man could, but the Hebrew wife could not divorce, whereas her husband might be forced to take at least a second wife, if not to divorce her, if she were childless after 10 years.
Marilyn Yalom, are there any constants at all through the two millennia plus that you research? Could you say, yes, this, this, and this are the constants in what comprises a wife?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer because each era, each place has had its own take on marriage. I mean, for example, the question of adultery. Certainly, we have a change in the early Christian era, and we do have to credit Jesus with taking the position that adultery was not the exclusive domain of the wife, that a man also could be an adulterer, which was not the case among the ancient Hebrews. So adultery has always been used against women more than it has been used against men.
Can I ask you, do you think this moment we are in now is a defining moment for the term wife? Because it seems to me that the one constant is that women have been subservient for the last 2,000 years.
Well, I do think that we have been moving away from the notion of subservience for a long time. I would say since the mid-19th century. And in fact, you could even push it back to the Reformation when women began to protest the idea, some women began to protest the idea that they had to be subservient to their husbands. And when a new model of yoke fellowship and of partnership began to enter into the world, into the Western world. So yes, I think that what we are seeing is a distillation of change that has been taking place for about 400 years.
Marilyn, we'll leave it there and continue after the break. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, all you aggrieved wives. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Here and Now at Noon, the latest on Providence Mayor Buddy Cianci's legal woes, and the regional press panel will talk about...
And marriage... Go together like a horse and carriage. This I tell you, brother, you can't have one without the other. Love and marriage, love.
We don't marry for sex, do we? We can get that anyway. We don't make our own money these days, and we don't need a husband for kids if we want kids. So what do we marry for? Do we marry for love? Why not settle for an affair and friends? Why be a wife? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. My guests today are E.J. Graff, author of What is Marriage For?, and Marilyn Yalom, author of A History of the Wife. Love and marriage, Marilyn Yalom, pretty new idea. The two are linked.
Well, the two have been linked for at least a couple hundred years and longer. Most historians seem to think that it was the period between the American Revolution and about 1820 when love became the primary criterion for choosing a spouse. And today it certainly is the gateway into marriage. It would be rare for someone to say, I don't love this person, but I'm going to marry him anyway.
Interesting. You, the introduction to your book starts with a Dear Abby letter, and she says this man is absolutely wonderful. He adores her. He adores her children. He's a great provider. He's absolutely everything she could hope for, except he doesn't set her heart on fire. And Dear Abby says, don't marry him.
Yes, she does. And I ask my readers if Dear Abby has given good advice. Certainly, there are reasons other than having one's heart go pit-a-pat for marrying a man who has, you've been living with, who's been taking care of your child, who provides for you in so many different ways. So I'd have to know a lot more about that situation before I'd take the position that Abby took, which was to say, no, don't marry him.
E.J. Graff, is it about love?
Well, I think the song that started, that we just heard, Love and Marriage Go Together Like a Horse and Carriage, You Can't Have One Without the Other, that dates that idea. The idea that you can't have one without the other does come from the horse and buggy era. That's really where it came from. It's that just pre-19th century idea. Certainly you could have it when the purpose of marriage was, when marriage was a kind of business, when marriage was, as it was for so much of history, really an economic bargain, the way that families with property exchanged that property and the way that the rest of us exchanged our labor and found a way to live that was not entirely dependent. Then it was more like finding a compatible workmate, really a life partner in the way that you would found a business with somebody. You're not going to break up the business because you're not in love. But if you've come to be very affectionate toward each other, that's going to make the business run more smoothly, and that'll be a good thing.
So it sounds like you're saying that you stick to some of the same tenets as existed in old marriages, but they're being redefined.
Completely redefined as you get the ability to make your living independently. That just shook up marriage very, very dramatically. You get three major debates over the very central purposes of marriage. And Marilyn may have to correct me on my history, but the debate over contraception. Is sex legitimate if it's not making babies? Right that second. If it does, that second does not have the possibility of making babies. That was a very nasty, bitter fight in all the Western countries. One practically on the ground by 1920, 1930, but not in this country, put into every state's law until 1965, Griswold versus Connecticut. And then there's the debate over whether marriage is immoral if you don't love each other. That's the debate over divorce, which really split the churches in this country. Go ahead.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, so I can defer to somebody else. Shannon is calling us from Louisville, Kentucky. Shannon, what's your question?
I have a question about the perception of the role of the wife in child rearing and childbearing, because in my experience, my husband is a resident, and I'm finishing medical school. We had a baby 2 weeks before my second year of med school and during his first month of internship, and people would come up to me and say, you know, this is a really hard time for him. Have you considered taking some time off? And I've been told, now that we do the same job, we're both in orthopedic surgery, I get told, you know, you don't have to stay for the late case. Why don't you go home and be a good mom?
Oh, exactly. Marilyn, what do you say to that? Still shoving women into stereotypes, even when they're absolutely the equal of their husband in every way.
Well, it's very hard to undo hundreds and thousands of years of history. Even when one thinks that one is enlightened, we act in ways that our parents and our grandparents and our ancestors acted. I can remember so clearly when my teenage daughter, and this was already some time ago, looked at me one day and she said, why are we serving the men in this family? And I thought at that point, that's a very good question, but one that I had never asked myself. And at that point, we decided that she and I would no longer be serving the food at table, and that the men could certainly clear away the dishes and begin to help with the cooking. And that was a real revolution in our marriage. But I sympathize with the young women with the young woman. It's very hard to change societal attitudes overnight.
E.J. Graff, what do you think about Shannon's point? Can we equate the role of the wife with the struggle for sexual equality?
Absolutely. That was, if I were to name the three big changes that came in marriage after the Industrial Revolution, 1850 to 1940, it would be that struggle for divorce, the struggle for contraception, and the struggle for female equality, which had existed in a different way before when women and men were interlocking labor. You really, a woman had more power if she had a good third of the property settled on her by her father, and if she had to do her job for the two of them to survive. This new model where you're supposed to stay home and take care of the baby to the exclusion of anything else is very, it's a real burden.
Well, indeed. And I mean, you were hopping mad before the first break because I said, you know, women were still subservient and through two millennia they've been subservient. And no, you're wrong.
I don't think so.
Hasn't Shannon proven that still women are under the thumb?
Actually, my point is a different one. I would say women were more subservient in 1900 than they had been in much of history. That, in fact, women lost ground over time and then have started to regain it. But it is a long, slow struggle, and I would not say. There are times I am very happy that I'm married to another woman.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Vanessa joins us from Pocatello, Idaho. Vanessa, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What would you like to tell us?
Well, I was just calling to put in a vote for marrying for love. I've been married for just a little over a year. My husband and I were married, and when we got married, we didn't have any money. We're both still in college, and I'm currently filling the role of, you know, the wife. I cook, and I love to cook, but I think one common thread in our marriage is that we have a lot of respect for each other. And I think maybe in relationships where women aren't feeling as equal or as respected, it's due to maybe a lack of respect.
Vanessa, is your marriage then very much like your mother's and your grandmother's? You say you cook, you love cooking. I mean, did you grow up thinking, I like that traditional role, that's what I want to do?
You know, my mother and my grandmother both, you know, stayed home. They both, you know, fulfilled the role of the traditional wife, and it seemed to work in our family, and so that's why I decided I wanted for my family, too. Currently, I'm a student. We don't have any children, and so it's just my husband and I, and we both do what we can, but he helps out when he can, and I think that it's working out really well for us, and I think that marriage can be a great thing, and I think being a wife can be a great thing as well.
Vanessa, thanks very much indeed for
All right.
That. Marilyn, is that true, that this sort of model of women staying home, having the children? I mean, let's face it, there are differences in the sexes, and only the women, at least at the moment, can have the children. I mean, does that model endure?
That model endures, but only for a small percentage of society, because only a small percentage of society today can afford to have a wife at home. Probably over 65% of wives are in the workforce today. Another third are outside of the workforce. And people who have children, mothers who are married, move in and out of the workforce. And it's only about 10% who seem to be electing to stay out of the workforce permanently, and they make that choice because they can afford to.
Well, let's talk about the models of marriage. We're joined now by Nancy Cott, author of Public Vows. Nancy Cott, welcome to the program, another author of another book about marriage, the history of marriage in the United States. And yours focuses on the public aspects of marriage and what the government wants marriage to be. But your book also looks at other examples, other models, that are not the consensual, monogamous, husband-provider, wife-dependent in American history. First of all, tell us about Native Americans, not Christians, obviously, the Iroquois, whole different model.
Yes, indeed. Well, it's nice to join you. And I like to emphasize how far a particular model of marriage has been very central public institution in the United States. You might even call it our civil religion. But making it central and the American way of life has meant being rather repressive to groups on our continent or immigrants who practice a different style. I mean, marriage has all sorts of varieties. And when the American Republic was founded, at the beginning of the United States, most of the continent was inhabited by people who didn't believe in lifelong, sexually faithful marriage, but rather several systems, polygamy, matrilineal kinds of family continuity, monogamous marriage that allowed self-divorce and remarriage. And these were considered something that had to be changed in order for Native Americans even to be able to make treaties with the United States, as well as eventually to become citizens.
How was it then stamped out? Because you described this sort of Iroquois community where they're very kind of loose and extended marriages, if you could define it that way.
Yeah, well, I think just the practices were more various. In fact, a lot of the practices that were frowned on by ministers and by government authorities in the Indian Bureau were actually being practiced by white Americans all over the place. They just weren't authorized, but people getting married, then one partner, usually the husband, deserting, remarrying some distance from the original marriage, people marrying themselves because there was no official around who was authorized to do so. Other forms of adultery, obviously, which always go on. But, I mean, when the ways that Native Americans were encouraged, incentivized, or compelled to conform to a Christian model of marriage was through financial incentives, through treaties that forced them onto certain territories that then policed them, set up legal systems that only allowed property to those who had proper male heads of households.
Can you explain this, though? Why, in your view, this traditional role of the wife plays such an important part in the structure of the U.S., indeed the structure in most Western countries, that it has to be this man-to-woman relationship, consensual, monogamous, or at least not admitting not being monogamous, that it has to be this structure? Why?
Well, frankly, I think what's been more important from the point of view of government authorities and perhaps the Protestant Church, too, is the position of the husband. That is, marriage is very much a way to discipline men, to keep men as the providers for their families, therefore people who will knuckle down and apply themselves to their work rather than roaming around, possibly impregnating lots of women in eras when there was no contraception, not being responsible for supporting their progeny. And marriage, from the state's point of view and from the national point of view, is at least as much about creating the appropriate sort of upstanding male citizen as it is about keeping the gender order in place and keeping women in a particularly sexually differentiated role, which is not that of the citizen and the provider.
You don't think that it was actually trying to provide a stable household for the for raising children?
Oh, definitely that. But when I say that it was important to keep the husband disciplined so he would provide for his children, the children are very much in mind and bringing up the next generation of adequate citizens. So that while, of course, the kinds of things you've been discussing about differences, gender differences between women and men, the expectation that women's labor and their economic values will be directed to the benefit of individual men, those things are very much in mind, but it's not as though marriage is about freedom and power for the husband only. It's also about certain men in power prescribing a role for the rest of the men in the society, which will make the rest of those men think about their responsibilities to their dependents.
Nancy Cott, for the moment, thank you. Let's bring Al into the conversation. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, to join the wife conversation. Al, tell me about your wifely experiences.
Well, I wanted to comment about something very interesting I noted when a couple of years ago, a company I worked with formed a joint venture with a Dutch company.
Mm-hmm.
And initially, the Dutch people came over to the States with their I'll call them partners, which I'll come to in a moment. And we're introduced to potential clients and so forth as, you know, this is my wife and they had children. And when we moved back to Holland, I discovered that, in fact, in Holland, you can either get married or you can get a legally living together contract. And a large proportion of the population seems to sort of throw away the concept of marriage and lives with this legal living together contract, very consciously refers to their partner as a girlfriend or boyfriend, you know, someone who they've lived with for 10 years and had three kids with, still is referred to as a, you know, boyfriend or girlfriend, just because the sort of attitude toward marriage is so, I guess, antiquated? I don't know. It struck me as odd.
Al, thanks for that. Let's put that to Marilyn Yalom, the history of the wife. Marilyn, you say this is a defining moment. From what Al has said, do you think the traditional wife role is dying out, if not dead? Is this the future that Al's talked about?
No, I don't think so, but I think that there are certainly many more options available to women and to men today. One can cohabit with a partner, one can defer marriage, one can choose not to marry, or one can, in fact, have some kind of civil union with a partner in the countries to which this man was referring, Holland and the Scandinavian countries. Now, it is true that many people are choosing not to marry, and that many babies are being born out of wedlock, up to 40% in the United States and up to 50% in Great Britain. And so marriage for having offspring, which was once the premier or the primary reason for marrying, that reason has become less important if one can have a baby outside of marriage and not encounter great stigma. But what one does encounter if you are a single parent and you don't have a partner helping to raise that child is that you're very likely to live in poverty in this country.
Al, thanks very much for that point. My thanks to Nancy Cott, professor of history at Yale and author of Public Vows. So what we're asking this hour is, what's a wife these days? Is it a Mrs. Him is getting hitched a good deal anymore? The number to ring, 800-423-8255. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Here and Now at noon, Red Sox Nation revs up for the hometown opener, and there's a taste test.
Best, are you one, and if so, why? Is it our role to support and be supportive, handle the workplace and the home front? Bad deal, why sign up? Is being a wife a high price for love? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. My guests today are E.J. Gruff, author of What's a Marriage For?, and Marilyn Yalom, author of A History of the Wife. Marilyn Yalom, we've been talking a lot about the Western model, but there are other models out there. There are arranged marriages. Do you believe that the Western model is leading the world, that soon the rest of the world will adhere to whatever is decided here?
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, we do tend to set the model for the rest of the world. It's interesting that in some countries which become westernized, some African countries, for example, the model of monogamy in marriage does take hold. But you are absolutely right that ours is not the only model. Polygamy certainly exists in many Muslim countries. We do have many countries where people live together without the benefits of marriage. And so I think it's difficult for us to say that the Judeo-Christian model is the one that will prevail. But we should underestimate our role as world leaders. And the way in which our image of the couple and of marriage and of the American family is propagated worldwide and the influence that that has.
E.J. Gruff, what do you think? Is this model going to spread?
I can't answer that question. I actually want to drag you back to something that Al raised just before the break. Essentially, when he was saying, you know, were these his Dutch co-workers they said they were married, but they weren't married. Well, that's an enormous question. And that's a question of what is marriage that has bedeviled marriage commentators from early Christianity to certainly to courts today. Are you married when you say, you know, to each other that you have a lifetime bond that you will respect? Is that marriage? You know, in that case, I would be married. Are you married when you have a ceremony that sort of celebrates your bond and with your community? Also, in that case, I would be married. Are you married when the state puts its little stamp on your piece of paper? Well, there, obviously, I'm not married. And that was the question for him with his Dutch co-workers. Which kind of marriage did they have? But in fact, even in Western history, we have a real array of marriage models. There was one, trying to remember now, one survey of one 14th century English village in which they found that of the couples who were counted as married, 89% of them had never gone up in front of an official. They had moved in together and then were considered by their community as married.
But are there some constants as well? Because your own economic situation is difficult, isn't it? Because you talk about, you know, having the little rubber stamp at the local official office or whatever. I mean, it does make a difference. Is it still some sort of contract where the woman has this defined role or the partner has a defined role?
Well, now, here's my question of what is marriage for? Why do you need that rubber stamp? I don't even know if it's rubber since I've never gotten it. I'm going to mention it again. What is the purpose of that? If all those economic, you know, all those things that you mentioned, if those are no longer purposes of marriage, women can certainly, and even couples can have babies without that official marriage, and the state will certainly hold the father responsible. The state's very intent about that. If you can leave each other, if you can have companionship and love without that stamp, what is it for? What is it left for? And I would say that that purpose is justice. You certainly don't need it when you love each other, when you're healthy, when everything is going well. But we don't live in that 14th century village where everybody knew everybody and was going to hold them to their commitments. We live in a world of anonymous institutions, an incredible number of strangers who have to somehow figure out which relationships they're going to take seriously. And that's what that little piece of paper is for. It tells food stamp programs, hospitals, cemeteries, every possible kind of institution, insurance companies, frequent flyer miles, whether or not this is a relationship where the two people have committed themselves to honoring each other.
Quick point, though, to Marilyn Yalom. Do women, a lot of women, still want the security of that role, that stamp that says wife? Because an awful lot of women, though they thought women would not be taking their husband's name, increasingly, women are taking their husband's name.
Well, women take their husband's names, and some do not take their husband's names. Those who feel that it would be disadvantageous to them not to continue to use the name by which they are known professionally often hold on to their own names. Certainly in my professional world, most of the women I know keep their names because with divorce a reality for one in two marriages, you might have to take that your name back again. And I think it's important to be known under your original name. But many other women choose to take on the name of their husbands. And so at this moment, I don't think you can say it's one way or the other.
Did you take on the name of your husband?
I know.
You've been married for 46 years, haven't you?
Yes, I took his name when I was married. I don't know whether I would do it today, but my whole life as an adult woman has been as a married woman.
I'd advise you just to choose which name is best, actually. Anyway, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Jerry joins us. Jerry, hello. Are you for marriage? Happy being a wife?
I'm happy being a wife. I'm just turned 50. I celebrated my 25th anniversary this year, and I think marriage is really at its best because there are so many models, and you can choose, you and your husband or significant other, if that's the way your arrangement is, can choose the way you want to set up your life, whether the wife is the primary earner or the husband is the primary earner, who gets to take care of the children. Those are all decisions that everyone gets to make for themselves.
Jerry, with such a reasonable attitude, I'm not surprised you've been married for 25 years. Congratulations. Thanks very much for your, for your call. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Larry joins us. Larry, what do you think about the wife?
Yes, I'm I am not married, but when I look at a relationship between a man and a woman and a husband and wife, they take on an archetype. There's so many expectations that we have of what a couple is supposed to do, but ultimately the man and the woman have to take responsibility for what they're going to do, what they're going to bring, and what they're going to take out of a relationship. Somebody has to provide, as the last caller said, some money, some security for a child, and I think the ultimate goal of us as human beings is to serve others. It's a shame that in this society, men and women don't place a value on being a mother, or being a wife, being a husband. And it's a shame that people are more concerned about what other people think of them as opposed to how they think about themselves.
What is the value, Larry? Because I think it was in Ibsen in the Doll's House, Helma says to Nora, you know, before everything else, you're a wife and a mother. And she says, I don't believe that any longer. I believe that before everything else, I'm a human being just as much as you are. That was in 1879, caused an uproar. I mean, are you saying that he was right? Yes, you know, you should first of all be a wife and mother and be a human being second. Hello, Larry?
Mm-hmm.
Larry's gone.
Oh, that's too bad, because I have a friend I want him to marry. If his goal is to serve others.
This is the Connection Dating Agency. Well,
well, you know, that is still a radical position for many people, the position that Ibsen took, because the independence of a woman and her role as the nurturer do often come in conflict. And society often tells the woman, as they did our caller earlier today, that her major role is to go home and take care of the children. So I don't think that this conflict has by any means been resolved 121 years, 22 years after the Doll's House.
E.J. Graff.
Oh, absolutely right. It's still very difficult. And I just want to propose a solution, which is that one way to shatter that archetype is to allow two people of one sex to marry, which I think you didn't laugh. I'm very pleased. I think that is considered radical by many of the forces in this country precisely for that reason, because the idea of two people who would be really equal. I mean, obviously, individuals are going to struggle for power. That's one of the little secrets of marriage, is that you're always struggling slightly over.
But in that case, do you think that wife should be one thing, or spouse should be one thing, mother should be another? There should be two completely separate arrangements, relationships, definitions of relationships. If you're going to be a parent, you're something else.
Well, I think the truth is those words are actually very baggy words, and no matter how much the archetype is imposed upon you, everybody's going to invent it in a way that works for them. That's more true now than in a society where there are much more, there's much more observation of your minute-by-minute life. The model that two people of one sex could marry really would be a public, a public
affirmation.
Exactly, of the idea.
Great minds.
That of the idea that you each can choose which part of marriage and family you're going to take on.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Todd joins us from Louisville, Kentucky. Todd, welcome. What are you doing home at this hour?
Well, actually, it's, I'm a stay-at-home dad. I'm actually working at my part-time job. Shh.
What point would you like to make, Todd? Or just point out that as you're a stay-at-home dad, you know, marriage is very different.
It is. I think that as more and more women are making strides in the workforce, that there's a large number of stay-at-home dads, you know, million or so across the country, I think, now. And my wife and I have been married for over 10 years, and when we first got married and started talking about having children, we said we wanted to have one parent at home. We felt that was important.
Didn't think you should become the wife. I mean,
well, Does she come home and say hello, Mrs.? Talk about it at that point. And when our first child was born 4 years ago, my wife actually did stay home, a traditional marriage, and for the first couple of years, and we went through some difficult times, not only just foregoing the income of having one child, one parent working, but just some different things. And a couple of years into parenting, we found ourselves in the position of it making more sense for her to have for her to work and for me to stay home.
Could I add that there are 2 million stay-at-home dads full-time and another 3 million part-time stay-at-home dads in the United States?
Todd, thank you very, very much for your call. Have fun with your kids. I didn't ask you how many you've got, but anyway, have fun. Marilyn, can I ask you, if the role of the wife is changing so much, what does that mean for children?
It does mean that children are going to often have the experience of fathers and sometimes same-sex parents raising them. I think the essential thing that we have to remember is how difficult it is for a single person to raise children. We need a couple. And what is important is that that couple have a commitment to each other and to the child. We know from much research that divorce is very traumatic for children.
Could it be 2 women and 2 men?
It could be 2 women and 2 men. But what is essential is that the commitment be there. We bandy that word about. That's a real word, and that's a word that has enormous meaning. And I am very traditional in my feeling that the child should come first when you have a relationship with another person.
We'll go on to child connections next week, I'm sure. That's the end of the wife connection. Thanks to Marilyn Yalom, senior scholar at the Institute for Women and Gender at Stanford University and author of History of the Wife. Also to my studio guest, E.J. Graff, author of What's a Marriage For? Earlier you heard Nancy Kopp, professor of history at Yale University and author of Public Vows. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation on our website at theconnection.org. We had help today from Tim Monroe, Darren Manoogian, and Kim Bachari. The Connection is produced by Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Michael Kavanagh, Alison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, Christopher Sechaney. Graham Smith is our senior producer. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection. Au revoir.
This is WBUR.